This is Stuart Moxham of The Gist, and you are listening to 90.7 FM WGXC Acre.
The Catskill Town Board meets every first Tuesday of the month at 6:30 p.m. at the Catskill Town Hall and holds a committee meeting the third Wednesday of the month at 6:30 p.m. You can turn out in person at the Catskill Town Hall to speak at these meetings or tune in to a live web stream through the Catskill Town Board and WGXC. Go to wgxc.org/listen or click on the listen button at wgxc.org to tune in to any of the Catskill Town Board meetings, the first Tuesday of the month at 6:30 p.m. and the third Wednesday of the month at 6:30 p.m. at wgxc.org and townofcatskillny.gov.
WGXC underwriting support is provided in part by SunCommon, supporting vibrant communities across New York for 15 years, offering custom solar installations for homes, farms, and businesses. Information at suncommon.com.
Wave Farms WGXC is made possible in part by the generous ongoing support of Timothy Simmons of New York, New York. WGXC's sustaining supporters are among the station's most dedicated listeners. They care deeply about creative community radio, and their investment helps to sustain WGXC as a public platform for information, experimentation, and engagement in Greene and Columbia counties. You too can become a sustaining supporter by going to wgxc.org/donate and designating an amount of your choosing. Thank you for your support.
This is Tom Murray with the WGXC Daily News for Tuesday, May 30th. Go to the WGXC newsroom at wgxc.org for more information about any of these stories. Jamel Cutler reports for Columbia Green Media that the Columbia County Board of Supervisors wants to extend a tax hike, asking the state legislature to keep giving an extra 1% to the county and keep the county sales tax rate at 4%. Columbia County Board of Supervisors Chair Matt Morrell, a Republican from Stockport, explained that, quote, "The county originally passed this in 1995, and every 2 years we have to renew it, and that's what we're doing. The tax percentage will stay the same. It's not an increase. We currently get 4%. If we didn't do this 1% increase, we will be at 3%, unquote. Read more about this story at HudsonValley360.com. Mid-Hudson News reports that Vice President Kamala Harris addressed graduates of the West Point class of 2023 on May 28th, telling them that there is, quote, "no more noble work that a person can do than to serve our nation in uniform," unquote. Harris also said that, quote, "it is clear that you graduate in an increasingly unsettled world where longstanding principles are at risk. In Ukraine, Russia's aggression is an attack on the lives and freedoms of the Ukrainian people, an attack on international rules and norms that have served as the foundation of international security and prosperity for generations," unquote. Read more about this story at Mid-Hudson News. And Jamal Cutler reports for Columbia Green Media that Misty McGee, the Hudson Development Corporation executive director, announced on May 23rd that she is resigning, saying, quote, "I'm stepping down because after 2 decades in corporate America and this brief and profound period in service with the HDC, it's time to honor my entrepreneurial calling. It's in my DNA," unquote. McGee seemed to imply that she would be starting her own business, saying, quote, "both my grandmother and my mom had or have their own businesses. I grew up watching them take those risks by giving back to the community, so it's my turn. It feels right, and I'm honoring that entrepreneur calling," unquote. Hudson Development Corporation Board President Christine Jones said McGee only stayed in the job for a few months, but that, quote, "she's parting from us with no ill feelings. This is the perfect time for her to pursue her own personal business goal," unquote. Read more about this story at HudsonValley360.com. And read more about any of these stories in the WGXC newsroom at wgxc.org.
Hello and welcome to the better weather for Tuesday, May 30th. Local early morning temperatures range from 43 degrees in Copaic to 54 in Voorheesville. Regional average soil temperature is 60 degrees. Pollen levels for today will be high and don't expect that to change much this week. Today will be comfortable with low cloud cover, a light breeze, and a high of 78 at 3 p.m. Overnight dips to 48 degrees, then comes back up to 84 degrees tomorrow afternoon. Overnight, open up them windows, it's 55 degrees. Friday, hot 92 degrees with a stormy summer looking afternoon. Today's tide schedule is low tide at 6:29 a.m., high tide at 11:53 a.m., and low tide once again at 6:44 p.m. Today's river temperature will be 67 degrees and the tide strength will be average. Sunset today will be at 8:08 p.m. and sunrise tomorrow will be at 5:19 a.m. Looking way up, we see X-class flare chances are at 10%. Plasma winds will be slow at 378 kilometers per second with a thin density of 1 proton per cubic centimeter. Radio propagation conditions are currently fair below 8 megahertz till dark, then fair across the board overnight. The 24-hour predicted KP index is 1.6, quiet. The current sunspot number is 153. And this has been The Better Weather, brought to you by the Catskill Makers Syndicate.
This is WA3QIZ. Do you read me?
Seymour, isn't it about time you made a real friend?
Mother, please, I'm communicating with my fellow hams.
How do I talk? Push this button here. You're all losers!
And we got a caller. We're going to the phones right now. Tom Rowe, I believe you have... on our new phone line, might even be coming from Scotland, a caller. Let's go.
Hello?
Okay, so caller, how's it going and what have you to report to us?
Well, I came back yesterday from a week in Scotland, touring around Edinburgh, Inverness, the Isle of Skye, Port William, sort of like a circuit.
You were all over Scotland. So you went from being Rob around the county, from Columbia County, the beautiful reporting on WGXE on the Monday afternoon show and others, to reporting around the Scotland counties. And how did that go for you, Rob?
It went nice. I basically went on my own and joined a tour, so there were 8 or 9 people, and we were at the same hotels. After the tours, I would go out. I went out to check the nightlife. So Inverness had probably the best time I had. Was there were pubs down there, bars there that had Scottish people playing Scottish tunes, fiddling, guitar, accordion, so forth. So I got the experience there. Edinburgh, there was a show where they put on the Highland dances with women. Young girls were doing the dances and the bagpipe and all that sort of stuff.
Were the Scotsmen getting a little rowdy on you?
The rowdiest time I saw was at a karaoke in Fort William. The place was... It's funny, you go down a steep staircase into an alley and into this pub or bar, and it was packed, and people were jumping around. I mean, there was a lot of great energy in there, probably the most I've ever seen.
Wow, that sounds pretty good.
And then I've got, I've... took quite a few photographs of the scenery of the Highlands and the island, and so there's a lot to see. Edinburgh is fascinating because it's the capital of Scotland. It has very old buildings that go back centuries, and they have trolley cars. They have rails. They have all kinds of, ways of getting around, by bus, by the trolley, by cab.
So would you say their public transportation system is a little bit ahead of ours?
Yes. And the tracks are, the trains go much faster than we could ever go. Their tracks can hold very fast speeds, very fast speeds. They've done work keeping their infrastructure... I think that's why we have the derailments, because things are not being repaired.
Interesting. Very interesting. I am so glad that you were able to get over to Scotland, over to the homeland. We've talked on our show a bunch about Ireland, and we've sung songs with Garrett Roach about Ireland, and we've sung the Wolf Tones on the One Road. So you going over to Scotland and reporting back here on the Monday afternoon show, Rob Gallus, I got to say, is really, really great. So thank you so much.
Kieran, when something comes up down the road, I'll do the same again. I'll contact you ahead of time if there's something to talk about of interest. So,
absolutely. And it's always interesting, Rob Gallus. And your Rob Around the County segments, you know, we're going to hear them on WGXC. We hear them often. And you've just done such a great job at capturing certain stories from individuals within Columbia County in particular, to just give an oral tradition, oral history, you know, project here on the radio show. So it's great work, and I'm so glad you got to Scotland. And what else, what other parting thoughts do you have, or are you thinking?
Well, I'd say the positive, I'd say, like Garrett talks about positivity, I found a lot of positivity most places in that I was traveling to. There are a lot of people, I met a lot of people from England that are visiting too. I didn't meet a lot of Americans out there. I met mostly English people that came up, had a, you know, a great time, got to talk to some, and so it was a very positive experience. It's very beautiful. I meant Ireland. I was in Ireland last year, so I've gotten to Ireland already. They're different. They're different feel. There's a different atmosphere, I think, in Ireland than Scotland. It's hard to tell unless you've visited both. There's a difference, I think.
Amazing, Rob Gallus. Just absolutely amazing. I wish I could have been there with you. But thank you so much for the call and the report on your trip to Scotland.
Well, thank you for reaching out. As I said, I reached out when I was in Scotland, I think. Then I did talk to you by text when I was there. So if I travel around, the next time I go traveling somewhere else, you know, I like to do another segment. Who knows where I'll be the next trip I go.
All right, sounds good.
Welcome to 2023 Talks, where we're following our democracy in historic times.
On this day, we come together again to reflect, to remember, but above all, to recommit to the future our fallen heroes fought for.
On Memorial Day, President Joe Biden delivered remarks at Arlington National Cemetery and laid a wreath honoring fallen service members. Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, General Mark Milley, and Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin also spoke. President Biden and House Speaker Kevin McCarthy are working to convince their caucuses to pass legislation to codify their agreement on raising the debt ceiling. Republicans got some, but not all, the spending cuts they wanted, some of which will extend for a decade. North Carolina Representative Patrick McHenry called it the most conservative spending package of his time in Congress.
The difference between our perspective and their perspective is enormous. So for us to draw them down and actually have spending restraint year over year and within a Congress is truly transformational.
The Supreme Court will soon announce decisions on student debt relief, affirmative action, and the Voting Rights Act in a case focusing on an Alabama dispute over when states must draw minority-majority voting districts. California Democratic Representative Katie Porter said Americans' confidence in the Supreme Court is at a record low and is among a growing number calling on the Supreme Court justices to be held to a code of conduct after conservative justices Clarence Thomas and Neil Gorsuch have come under scrutiny over financial disclosures.
The problem is not that the Supreme Court is just conservative. The problem is that it's corrupt.
According to a new survey by the University of California, Berkeley, former President Donald Trump has retaken the lead from Florida Governor Ron DeSantis among likely California Republican primary voters. The survey found 44% would support Trump, while 26% would support DeSantis. Over the weekend, the Texas Republican-led House of Representatives impeached Republican State Attorney General Ken Paxton over allegations of bribery and abuse of public trust. Texas Representative David Spiller was among one of the Republican members of the committee who brought forth the articles of impeachment.
No one person should be above the law, least not the top law enforcement official of the state of Texas.
Under Texas law, Paxton has been temporarily removed from office pending a Senate trial. Paxton responded to the impeachment saying corrupt politicians in the Texas House are demonstrating that blind loyalty to Speaker Dade Phelan is more important than upholding their oath of office.
They have denied me the opportunity to present the evidence which contradicts their politically motivated narrative, and they are showcasing their absolute contempt for the electoral process.
I'm Alex Gonzalez for Pacifica Network and Public News Service. Find our 8 trust indicators to support transparency and accuracy at publicnewsservice.org.
You're listening to the American Democracy Minute, keeping your government by and for the people. It's baseball's All-Star Week, and a new study suggests that you might want to get out to your local ballpark or basketball arena to exercise your freedom to vote. The Civic Responsibility Project commissioned a study by a panel of experts during the 2020 election and found that sports stadiums make an excellent voting venue. In fact, 48 Major League Baseball, NBA, NHL, MLS, and NFL sports stadiums and arenas were used for voting in 2020. But the value of sports facilities goes beyond social distancing. The study found that stadiums are often located in densely populated metropolitan areas, accessible by mass transit. The facilities are capable of moving people in and out, are handicapped accessible, have adequate bathrooms and parking, and are in general easy to get to. Staff at the stadiums are used to the logistics for games, concerts, and other large events. After decades of not being out front on social justice issues, many pro sports franchises are now looking for opportunities to be better corporate citizens. Providing valuable support for voting and civic engagement in their communities is an excellent way to do that. Voters like it too. The Civic Responsibility Project found that 2020 voters came from a wide range of political, racial, and cultural backgrounds, and stadium voting didn't benefit any particular group of voters. Seems like stadium voting is, well, a home run. A link to the study is at our website, AmericanDemocracyMinute.org. For the American Democracy Minute, I'm Brian Beal.
If you would like to be on the radio at WGXC 90.7 FM, now's your chance. Want to fulfill a long-time or newly emerging desire to be on the radio? Want to become part of the community conversations on Wavefarms WGXC 90.7 FM, radio for open ears? You have an idea for a short recurring segment? Tune into a Zoom meeting May 30th at 6 p.m. online. Contact content at WGXC.org to register and with any questions. But we would love as many voices as possible to be on the radio at WGXC, and this is your chance. All right, I'm Tom Rowe in Acre, and you have tuned into the WGXC, and our next guest is here with us live. This is Kristen Gamble, the president of the Hudson Athens Lighthouse Preservation Society Board, and the Hudson Athens Lighthouse is in the news, you'll tell us about that in a second, but tell us, what is the Hudson Athens Lighthouse? How long has it been there? Tell us, like, the basics.
Looking forward to having this conversation, Tom. So the Hudson Athens Lighthouse is actually 149 years old. Next year we celebrate our 150th year, so we're looking forward to that. It was built in the middle of the Hudson River. It was actually an engineering marvel from that time period. And the reason that it's an engineering marvel is, in fact, that it sits in the middle of the river, which means it is not on a rock and it's not on land. It is on 200 wooden pilings, and then the granite is on top of that in terms of the lighthouse itself.
Do you know why because most lighthouses you see are on the shore. Why did this one go in the river?
There was a sandbar just underneath the water level, just north of where the Hudson Athens Lighthouse is. And the reason it was built in the middle of the river is to ward off the ships. There were a lot of shipwrecks there before the lighthouse went in. And so the reason was very simple, and that is that it was a indicator to the ship captains that that sandbar was there, and so that it prevented a lot of shipwrecks. So the lighthouse today is it's loved by people on both sides of the river and all of the local communities. It is not controversial at all. It is everybody, all walks of life and political predilections love it. And that's why we have recently been able to pull together a number of our elected officials, both of both parties, to try to raise some money for the restoration of the lighthouse. But let me just go in a little bit to some thinking about why we're having to do this. Everybody loves the lighthouse, but they don't give a thought to who's responsible for it. And they just kind of assume, I think, that shrug their shoulders and say, oh, it must be the Coast Guard, or it must be New York State. Well, that is not the case. The Hudson Athens Lighthouse Preservation Society has the sole responsibility for the lighthouse. And this is an all-volunteer organization that was pulled together in about 1980. And before that, actually it had been boarded up because the last lightkeeper who lived on the lighthouse departed in about 1949. So there it was boarded up for a while, and then the Lighthouse Preservation Society was formed, and we took responsibility for the maintenance of the lighthouse.
And you guys run tours, too? People can come and visit?
We do. We do. Let me just finish this train of thought for a second. And in the year 2000, actually, the Coast Guard, which had previously owned it, gave us the deed to the lighthouse. And, in fact, this is in the year 2000. We actually own the bottom of the river. They gave us a deed with a circular diameter around the lighthouse of 100 feet. So we own the lighthouse, and we own going down to
the
bottom of the river.
There's not too many people that can say they own part of the Hudson River,
right.
I would guess.
And we do. So that factors into some of the plans that we have. So anyway, that's I hasten to say also that the Hudson Athens Lighthouse is listed on both the national and state registries of historic places and is a New York State chartered museum. We have the distinguished honor of having been declared by the New York the Preservation League of New York as one of the seven to save. Every other year they come out with a list of places.
Not just lighthouses, but just places in
general.
Yes,
places all over the state. And so in the year 2021, we were named one of the seven to save, which was a big achievement. And they've been very helpful in terms of some financial support, but also just the recognition that the lighthouse is something that's very important to save. Also, I would add that the Architectural Digest some years ago, and I quote, called the Hudson Athens Lighthouse one of the country's boldest and most beautiful lighthouses. So that adds to the aura that it has. The Coast Guard does use the lighthouse now, and it has a light up in the tower. And it still serves as a navigation aid for the whole, for the Hudson.
So if GPS goes out for an evening, the boats are covered.
Yes, exactly. So, and that's an important aspect to the history and certainly why it should be saved today. So the interestingly, the ship channel, when it was first built, was on the Athens side, or the west side, of the Hudson River. And about 70, maybe 100 years ago, the ship channel was changed to the Hudson side. So this gives the distinction of the ship channel determines what the location is and which county, because it's Greene County on the west side and it's Columbia County on the east side. So the lighthouse moved from being in Columbia County to being in Athens or in the Greene County, and yet it didn't move.
So you own a part of the Hudson River
right.
that was in a different county and moved to a different county without moving.
Yeah, right. There you go. It's clear as mud. Huh? Right. Anyway, so the situation today is that the maintenance of the lighthouse, there's certain aspects of the lighthouse that need restoration. And it starts with the underwater part, the pilings. And what's happened is when the ship channel was changed to the east side of the river, the Army Corps of Engineers dredged the channel because it was able to be deeper and wider in terms of enabling larger ships to be navigating the river. And, you know, the history of the Hudson River has always been commercial in navigation, ship traffic, and it still is. But what has happened in recent years is that the size of the ships going by is wider, deeper, and faster. And as much as they try to go slowly past the lighthouse, there is an unintended consequence that when they go by the lighthouse, the underwater activity is exaggerated. And there's a swell pulled away from the lighthouse, and then the water gets pushed back to the lighthouse. And what this has done is affected the mud packing that is around the pillars, the pilings of the lighthouse. So Amsterdam is built partly on pilings put in hundreds of years ago, and even Venice has some pilings. So the pilings are an old technology, but at the same time, because of the increased ship traffic, it has begun to pull away some of the mud piling that's around the pilings. And the reason that's a problem is that then the pilings are exposed to oxygen and that H2O, water, and that begins to weaken them. So there are probably, you know, a handful of cases where we now know that the pilings no longer support the lighthouse itself. They're not connected. But, I mean, it doesn't mean it's going to fall into the river right now. It is certainly safe to go out there. And it's a joy, in fact, to go out there. But the increased ship traffic has pulled away that packing and, in fact, some of the riprap, which is the stones that get put around the bottom. And if we just simply put the mud back and put the stones back, the same thing would continue to happen. So that's not a good
solution. The lighthouse
solution
was built for an age where there were more ships on the Hudson River, but the ships that are now there are faster and stronger and make bigger waves.
Yes. So yes. They scour. The word they use is scour the bottom.
So the lighthouse wasn't built for today's traffic on the river.
Correct.
So you need to improve it, I guess. You want to create a better foundation that can withstand the current traffic?
Yes. And we also have to consider sea level rise, So that's another consideration that we're taking into account. We have a plan, a concept plan, which has been pulled together very meticulously with our engineering firm. And the plan is this, that we could actually put a steel curtain on our land in a circle around the lighthouse, and that then we could put the mud back to cover the pilings.
So the water would be removed from this circle, so that you could see the
bottom. Well, no, the water would still be there, absolutely. And then we'd have the riprap too, and that would be on both sides probably of the steel curtain. But that would prevent the scouring.
Oh, I see. This curtain would remain. It's not temporary to fix it.
No. This would be a permanent structure. And so this will enable the ship traffic to continue, which it, you know, needs to do. So that's, you know, as I say, kind of the history of the Hudson River. But also it will protect the pilings and we can go in and check some of them and reinstall a few of them that are around the edges that would be better if they were reinstalled or at least the top part of them.
And it's interesting you're thinking of climate change. This seems like the kind of work you'd only want to do like once a century or whatever. You want to do it and do it right worry about it for a while.
What we call it is the 100-year fix, literally. So you hit the nail on the head.
So how high will the water rise on the Hudson River?
Well, let me tell you.
No one knows for sure, I guess,
yeah,
right?
Nobody knows for sure. But I'll say two things. One, the Hudson River is tidal all the way up, and there can be the differentiation in a given day today of about 6 feet between high tide and low tide. So there is movement up and down now.
People don't think about that, but it is.
Yeah,
it is like going to the beach there.
Exactly. And there are predictions that the pace at which the sea level is rising is currently, it's up about a foot from maybe 30 years ago. And if it continues to rise at the same pace it is right now, it could be 4 to 6 feet higher in 100 years, or at the end of the century, actually. So it's a real problem, but it has a solution. But being in the middle of the river is an expensive place to
do construction.
You can't drive a truck up there.
It's hard to get contractors for house work, but I'm sure it's difficult to get.
This is a very specialty, you know, for sure. And so a lot of work has to be done from barges. And, in fact, it's a seasonal activity.
Because it can't happen in the winter.
No, because the Hudson River freezes over. I mean, you know, obviously, that Athens used to. Yeah, Athens was a source of a lot of ice that went down to.
There used to be those ice boats and everything.
Right, exactly. But we haven't had a total freeze in several years.
I don't think this winter, yeah.
No, it's been several years. But that doesn't mean it can't happen on the odd occasion. And so it has to be taken into account in terms of what we do. And so, but this is a very doable plan. We've been in touch with a couple of other lighthouses that have done something not identical but similar, and we have some learning that we've been able to do from their experiences too. There's the Huntington Lighthouse on Long Island has built a steel curtain around that too, but theirs is different in that it's actually on land, and it will a bit on a spit of land where the land is being eroded, and they have it filled with cement, but we cannot do that because of our different situation, because we'd have to have access to the pilings if we need it, but there's a lot of, you know, there are examples of this kind of thing being done. I would also add that there used to be 14 lighthouses on the Hudson River. At the current moment, the Hudson Athens Lighthouse is the northernmost of the lighthouses, and 7 north of us no longer exist. Now, they were not in the middle of the river. They were on the shore, but like on a spit of land. And again, the ice flows caused the damage that wore away the land that they were standing on. So that is unfortunate. But we want to keep the 7 lighthouses that are still here, but most especially we're focused on the Hudson Athens Lighthouse.
Because once they fall, they're gone to history. There's not usually a rebuilding of a lighthouse.
No. So that kind of leads to the subject of why, you know, what are you going to do with it when you restore it and save it? And the answer is it is already a real asset to our communities on both sides of the river. And it is a place that people love to go and to be out there and take one of the tours that we have. That being up in the tower, it's an experience like you've never felt before. It's exhilarating. And you get a totally different sense of the Hudson Valley by being up in the lighthouse. But beyond that, we do a lot of work with classes, grade school classes in both Hudson and Athens. And we also do tours on Waterfront Wednesdays, which happen in Hudson in the summer. And we do free tours then on the weekends. They are paid tours. And so, but we do that as a benefit to the community because that's what we do. We also recently have had a collaboration developing with the Columbia Green Community College, which is near the lighthouse as well. And we have reached out to them, and I'm happy to say, this fall going to be on the curriculum of the history department and the art department. And the history department is going to do some work on the building itself, but also on the archiving of a lot of the documents that we have that haven't been properly done yet. So it's going to be it's a wonderful connection.
And why the art department?
Because the art, the lighthouse inspires artists, and so hopefully they will do all sorts of creative things that cherish the lighthouse itself. So that's a good connection. But we also there are lots of events that happen there, and lots of local groups that want to go out and see that the lighthouse would be there. And we really want to be a community asset and be very connected to both sides of the river. So we're doing a lot more in programming, and this is all for the good. So
we're talking with Kristen Gamble, the president of the Hudson Athens Lighthouse Preservation Society Board, and talking about how the lighthouse could fall into the river if it's not fixed up soon, and you guys are working towards that. I guess the contractors can be found that they can do that work, but the big problem I'm guessing is coming up with the money to pay them all, because it sounds like it's an expensive
project. This is going to be
project.
An expensive proposition, yes. So I want to make sure I get to this. We have recently put out a press release which proudly tells everyone that we have worked behind the scene, and we have a person who has been particularly wonderful at this, Sue Seneca, and we have pulled together quotes and agreed upon efforts by are all the relevant elected officials for the two counties. So we have start with Chuck Schumer, the majority leader of the U.S. Senate, Kirsten Gillibrand, our other senator from New York, and Representative Mark Molinaro from the 19th District. And we also have New York State Senator Michelle Hinchey, New York State Assembly Member Dee Dee Barrett, and New York State Assembly Member Chris Tagg. All have come together. And if you think about that, there are two Republicans and four Democrats, and they have come together and have all agreed to push to get a $7.5 million budget from the Army Corps of Engineers, hopefully, and in the next budget, which would come in the fall. So,
and is that enough money?
Is for the foundation. Okay. So now, in terms of what we have already achieved, we have received a $500,000 grant from New York State. It's from the Environmental Protection Fund, channeled through the Office of Parks, Recreation, and Historic Preservation. And that required us as an organization to come up with $180,000 of matching funds for to receive the full amount of that $500,000 grant. And by the way, we're going to be putting in for a second $500,000 grant this season. So, and I'm happy to say that we not only have matched $180,000 that was necessary, but we've gotten even more, so we're over $200,000 now. This is all from the local community, people in the local community, and as well as some local banks and foundations. And so this is a major accomplishment, I think,
it
and it shows how much the people really love the lighthouse.
Yeah, no, we had to raise for a matching grant about that much money to get on the air about 10 or 12 years ago,
mm-hmm.
and it's a massive effort that you're working on all the time and asking everyone, and it's just this is not a super rich area, so
yeah.
There's not like enormous deep pockets available. You're
right.
To raise all that money from it must have been a large number of people. It took a lot of work.
It did, but people have been very generous. And so there's more to be done, by the way, lest there be any question about that. But we people have been very forthcoming, and as well as local businesses, too. But we have more to reach out to. And, in fact, we're going to be launching a petition drive now that we have this agreement from the elected officials that they're going to be pushing to get the $7.5 million from the in the next budget, and we have agreed to get a petition going, and some of it's going to be live in on a piece of paper in storefronts around the area, but some of it is online, and there's actually a place on our website www.halps.org. The HALPS stands for Hudson Athens Lighthouse Preservation Society. And so that there's a button you can push on the website to sign your petition, and we have a good number happening already. That just has gone up in the last week or so. And but it's also going to be in the local stores and locations. There are going to be, Flag Day parade, gatherings and all over the area, and we're going to have tables at many of those, and we'll be trying to get people to sign. And the other way that it would be very helpful is if people went actually to the websites of the elected officials and leave a little comment that you support the effort to fund the restoration project for the Hudson Athens Lighthouse, and that you support and are pleased with the fact that they've agreed to do this. So we have to compliment them and push them a little bit, both.
So getting in touch with your local elected officials that say you support this, either by signing the petition that'll be out and about this summer, or going to their websites. And I'm guessing you can also take donations at your website too.
Oh,
right?
Yes. And that's would be very helpful indeed, because that we still have a lot of money to raise, and it's an effort, but it's worth it.
So it's going to be an ongoing process.
This is a multi-year project.
What is your timeline looking like of raising money and starting construction and things like that?
There will be some things happening this year, but most of it will start next year. The physical, we've been doing a lot of background kind of stuff. You have to get permits for this and that, and there's a lot of paperwork that has to happen. Plus, Landmark Consulting, which is our running the effort in terms of the what needs to be done to do the proper restoration, they are finding that a lot of the best contractors have already been booked for 2023. So we're booking them for next year. We had hoped to get it started, more of it this year.
But there is
year,
a contractor shortage, like we were joking about.
Yeah. Hello. But I also have to put in a plug for Proper and O'Leary, who is our engineering firm, and they've done an enormous amount of work and really priced out everything. And so it's been all of it is such a collaborative endeavor. And just fundamentally, everybody wants the lighthouse to stay there.
And the tours, will they continue while the work goes on, or are they going to get interrupted?
Yes. Well, the plan is that the work will be done mostly Monday through Friday, and that they'll clean it up at the end of the week, and then the tours, which take place on Saturday. Now, the tours that happen on Waterfront Wednesdays may be curtailed a bit, but we'll see. We'll try to keep everything going.
Right. And that's the best way to come out and see the – I mean, it's the only way to come out and get onto the property. But
correct.
I guess you probably get some people in kayaks going by and looking.
Well, they go by and look, but they can't get up because our stairway lifts.
Comes
and,
up, yeah. Yeah. You need to be Spider-Man or something.
Right, exactly. But please don't.
We're not suggesting anyone do anything of that sort. So anything else that you need to tell us about the Hudson Athens Lighthouse? We've been speaking with Kristen Gamble, the president of the Hudson Athens Lighthouse Preservation Society, about trying to preserve the Hudson Athens Lighthouse so it doesn't fall into the river.
I think we've covered the high points. So it's a real effort, and it's an ongoing effort, and it won't happen overnight, but it's worth it.
So why don't you give that website address one more time if people want to donate or sign the petition or just find out more information.
Absolutely. It's www.halps.org.
That stands for Hudson Athens
Lighthouse Preservation Society.
Right. I think I've got it now. Hopefully our listeners do, too.
It doesn't flow that easily.
Halps, it's almost a word.
Exactly.
So it's a little difficult to approach. You think you're pronouncing a word, but it's not quite an actual word. Yeah. All right. Well, thank you so much for joining us today and telling us all about the Hudson Athens Lighthouse.
Well, Tom, thank you for inviting me.
Hopefully we will be able to talk about it for years to come on the radio.
Exactly. That's the goal.
I'm Tom Rowe in Acre, and this is the WGXC News Update. Go to the WGXC Newsroom at WGXC.org for more information about any of these stories. Kenneth C. Crowe II reports in the Times Union about the exhibition at the Mission House Museum in Stockbridge through November on Mohican history and culture from the Stockbridge Munsee community. The Mohicans were driven away from this area centuries ago and are now based in Wisconsin. Quote, we're hoping people have an opportunity to come. It's a tribal-produced exhibit here in our homeland, unquote, said Bonnie Hartley, tribal historic preservation manager for the Stockbridge Munsee community, Band of the Mohican Indians, another way the tribe is called. The exhibition is called, quote, Our Lands, Our Home, Our Heart, Nerekina Wikiyak Nadirana. During the show, the museum will host talks from Maggie Bennett on Mohican Travels Through Story Mapping on Saturday, September 23rd, from Kim Hoffman on Healing Within the Community on Monday, October 9th, from Lucy Grignon on Honoring Our Traditional Seed Relatives on Saturday, October 21st, from Dr. Sandy Barton on What is Indigenous Education, Saturday, November 4th, and from Misty Cook about tribal medicines on Monday, November 18th. Read more about this story in the Times Union. WNYT reports that New York Senators Chuck Schumer and Kirsten Gillibrand want a federal disaster declaration from the Department of Agriculture after a late frost last week hurt local vineyards, farms, and orchards. Apple and grape crops were hit hard by a late-season frost last week. One farming expert told the newspaper that 30 to 35% of the region's apple crop was lost in the frost. Michael Migliorelli, president of the Hudson Valley Wine and Grape Association, said of local growers, quote, the last time they saw a frost this late that caused this much damage was 60 years ago, unquote. Migliorelli's Ulster County vineyard lost between 50 and 60% of its grapes, while his Columbia County vineyard only lost about 5% of its grapes because its location on the east bank of the Hudson River was warmer. His Greene County vineyard was, quote, 100% wiped out, unquote. If the U.S. Department of Agriculture declares a federal disaster, farmers would be eligible to receive funds for their losses. Migliorelli said, quote, is it going to make up for what happened? No. Will it possibly give you a lifeline to keep you afloat and in business? Maybe, unquote. Read the full story at WNYT. Nick Reisman reports for New York State of Politics that there are battle lines drawn in New York politics on the migrant relocation issue. While members of both parties have made statements against governors of southern states or the mayor of New York City busing migrants around the country, that's where the agreement ends. Democrats have largely backed Governor Kathy Hochul's push to allow migrants seeking asylum in the U.S. the opportunity to work on a more expedited basis. Republicans generally don't want migrants housed in upstate New York. Democratic State Assemblyperson Pat Fahey is among the Democrats calling for President Joe Biden to change rules stopping new migrants from working right away. Fahey said, quote, having someone wait 180 days, you're almost inviting problems, and I think that's fueling some of the resistance. I've been dismayed to see some of the comments. We're New York. We have a history of being a welcoming state, unquote. Representative Mark Molinaro is not as welcoming, introducing what he calls the Schools Not Shelters Act on May 26th, a bill that would block Governor Kathy Hochul from using schools to shelter migrants. Hochul is discussing the possibility of housing migrants in SUNY college dorms in upstate New York this summer. Molinaro said, quote, upstate New York taxpayers pay thousands of dollars to support our public education system. SUNY college students pay thousands of dollars for room and board. Our schools are not shelters, unquote. During the COVID-19 pandemic, many public buildings were used in different ways to respond to the health crisis. Republican Senate Minority Leader Robert Ort blamed Washington politicians who have not updated migration policy in decades. Ort said, quote, I don't think anyone can argue that it's the failure of the border policy that it has partly led, partly to the crisis to begin with, unquote. Read more about this story at New York State of Politics. And read more about any of these stories in the WGXC newsroom at wgxc.org.
Next, we have an interview from
WOOC.
To learn more about this program, the Sanctuary for Independent Media, visit us online at mediasanctuary.org.
WOOC listeners may have heard this next guest on Tuesday as the Jazz Sanctuary DJ. He's a bass player. He has also been a DJ on WGXC and is also a stand-up comedian. Thank you for joining us. Brad Munkel, am I saying that correctly?
Munkel. Thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate it, and I'm glad to be at the Sanctuary for Independent Media. It's so good to be spinning for Jazz Sanctuary again.
Awesome. Welcome. So I understand you've been playing bass professionally for almost 8 years. Can you tell us a bit about your style, background, and influences?
Well, I started right out of high school playing musicals. I was really into punk rock back then, but there's no punk. I came from a small town in called Greenville, and there's no punk rock scene in Greenville. So I started out playing in one of my science teacher's bluegrass bands, and musicals, musical theater. But, you know, since then I've really gotten into playing jazz or just in general, you know, improvised music, funk. I end up doing a lot of pop stuff. And I just enjoy playing the bass, so I like playing whatever I get the opportunity to play. You know.
So with the stand-up bass, are there versions of punk with the stand-up bass?
Yeah. I guess like rockabilly is like a lot of people... I'm no expert on rockabilly, but I guess that's like where you would see it the most common, the closest crossover. And then there's like one of my favorite punk bands, the Minutemen. They had some like crappy quality video of Charlie Hayden, like the great jazz bassist who played with, you know, Ornette Coleman and people playing with them, like the Minutemen, which was a really cool thing for me to see. But it's not really a common thing. I guess it's something I wouldn't mind exploring more. I'm more into the jazz and funk now, but of course I would love to play with the ideas that come from punk rock, and it would be fun to do with something a little more out of left field like that.
Do you play other instruments?
Yeah, you know, I guess like after bass, next would be drums. You know, I play the most of, you know, I play some guitar, very little keyboardist. I was originally a really bad trombonist. That was my first thing. I was terrible at that. And I don't, you know, I've played a few gigs on guitar and a few like small performances on drums, but not, I really can't claim to do any of them that seriously. I wouldn't want to deceive people.
We all start somewhere, right?
Yeah. It's, I, like I said, I mean, I'm just happy to play. I love music. So.
And in 2019, you joined us as a Sanctuary Jazz DJ. What brought you here?
Well, at the time, I was playing wedding gigs with, you know, a bunch of different people. And I happened to be doing one night with Dylan Canterbury, who's a great trumpet player. And he was a former DJ for Jazz Sanctuary. And I just figured I'd ask him, like, how do you get into doing radio? So I just been thinking about it. I was terrible at talking to people, terrible at talking at my gigs. So I was like, I need to just make myself comfortable with the kind of thing. It seems fun. So
it was a practice. It was practice for like public speaking.
Yeah, I would mostly just like play music and not talk a lot at first because I was I was just like afraid I was gonna mess up or blank on what to say. But
radio is about embracing mistakes.
I've since learned. and doing stand-up comedy has doubly taught me that lesson where it's, you're gonna mess up and it's okay. And
I was gonna say, you said you lacked confidence on stage and now you're a stand-up comedian also.
Well, if radio helped, that definitely helped. That made me realize, oh yeah, you have to be not afraid to look stupid. And it's kind of, you know, it's kind of nice. It kind of makes me less afraid of bombing musically, like if I make a mistake on stage. But it's more about how you recover and being like confident and just having fun with it, and mistakes are going to happen. So they've all just kind of tied in together with making me more comfortable in front of people, which is, you know, the fun thing about performing, because I'm an awkward guy and I feel like I'm better at being a bassist than at being a person.
But comedy, you have the audience like giving you feedback right there. As a DJ, you have this protection of like the microphone. You're like, you know, unless somebody calls up or is like there, you don't know if somebody's reacting or looking at you. So, but how what's the link between the two of those for you?
I mean, you know, I took so much time off of doing live stuff on the air. Even when I had a show on WGXC, it was pre-recorded, which is a little weird. It's like there's a little bit of a disconnect, but since doing stand-up, there's definitely a more natural feel to just talking to the microphone, but it is weird. It's hard for me. Like, people say, like, oh, I picture the people I'm talking to sitting